So I'm going to be bringing you up to date with what's been happening on Miniboon. I'll start with a very brief overview, motivation for the experiment. Talk about the beam and the detector. Hopefully I can spend some time at the end talking about the neutrino analyses that we have ongoing at the moment, and then wrap things up. So by way of motivation, this is a familiar picture, of course, where we have the well-established solar and atmospheric measurements that we've been hearing about for the last couple of days. And we have an unconfirmed indication of oscillations, possibly at high delta M squared from LSND. This is potentially a revolutionary measurement, and I will just very briefly give an indication of why. LEP tells us that there are only three active light neutrinos, and so you saw from the mass scales on the previous slide that if all three of these indications of oscillations are indeed oscillations, then we have a problem. Something very fundamental has to give. There are many possibilities for what that might be. One popular solution is to add in sterile neutrinos extra flavors, but don't let them interact weakly. There's another interesting consequence of a Miniboon seeing a signal, which is the effect on future off-axis experiments. So I just throw in a teaser here. So what's shown here is the sensitivity to a null CP violation signal. So there's the CP delta angle here and sine squared 2 theta 1 3 here. And black is your 2 sigma sensitivity for a 5-year neutrino, 5-year anti-neutrino run using Nova anti-decay and a reactor experiment. So that's the case if Miniboon doesn't see a signal. If Miniboon sees a signal, then this acts as a background that needs to be subtracted off from the off-axis experiments. If Miniboon sees a signal in neutrinos and anti-neutrinos, you get the red curve. If Miniboon only sees a signal in anti-neutrinos, you get the blue curve. So this is something which, if there is an effect there, it's going to have an impact on future measurements as well. I will just very briefly remind you of the LSND results. The experiment ran at Los Alamos, and the LAMP beam there in the 90s. They were looking for an excess of nu E bar and a nu mu bar beam, and saw an excess, saw 4 sigma evidence for oscillation. What's shown here is the data as the black points, as the beam excess, so as beam off subtracted, as a function of L over E. The two classes of background are there in green and in red, and then an oscillation signal fit shown in blue. To check LSND, you don't just want to repeat the same experiment, you want to do something different. You want to have different systematics. You want to have higher statistics. The statistics here are quite healthy, but you'd really like to be able to start doing an experiment where you can really analyze the shape. So you'd like higher statistics, but of course you need to run at a similar L over E if you want to be sensitive to the same parameter region. And that leads us to Miniboon. The Miniboon collaboration is about 60 people from 12 institutions in the US, and the experiment is at Familab. The goal of the experiment is to definitively confirm or rule out oscillations as the source of the LSND result. By definitively, we mean that we would like to cover the LSND 90% confidence region at between 4 and 5, mostly 5 sigma. And so you can see this is our latest estimate of our sensitivity with 10 to the 21 protons on target with 90%, 3 sigma and 5 sigma contours overlaid. Miniboon, as a baseline, it's about 10 times LSND and an energy that's about 10 times LSND. So it's a completely different signal, which if LSND was caused by an unknown systematic effect, because this is a completely different signal and a completely different energy regime, we hopefully would not be subject to the same problems if there were any. So I'll take you now through a quick tour through the beam. We start with protons, 8 GeV protons from the Fermilab booster. Those are incident on a beryllium target inside a magnetic focusing horn. The proton interactions on beryllium produce all kinds of things, in particular mesons that are focused down by the horn. And those mesons then have about 50 meters in which to decay and produce neutrinos before they pass through about 500 meters of dirt to reach our detector. The booster is an old and venerable machine at Fermilab. It's been working harder this last couple of years than it ever has before. This number, we're currently averaging about 6 E16 protons per hour. This is probably, as of the last couple of weeks, a little out of date, because we're making extremely good progress improving the output from the booster and reducing the activation in the tunnel. We have so far reached about 28% of the 10 to the 21 protons that we need to do the measurement. The horn and target, so the protons impinge on this 71 centimeter long beryllium target before being focused by the horn. The horn is a real engineering tour de force. It takes 170 kiloamp pulses in short bursts at about 5 hertz. It's performed flawlessly for up to date about 80 million pulses, and it's still going strong. We have a spare horn ready and waiting should we have problems with this horn, but so far it's been performing beautifully. The main mu flux that we're interested in is produced from pion decay. So pion goes to mu. Of course, since we're looking for nu E appearance in a nu beam, we care a great deal about intrinsic sources of nu E's from mu's, k's, and k pluses and k longs. And we have a variety of systems where we hope to be able to understand and accurately characterize what our beam looks like. So currently, we use the E910 experiment, and we've had some people within our collaboration reanalyzing that data, as well as previous world meson production experiments, to do a global fit, and that's the basis of our pion production currently in our Monte Carlo. We also are involved in the HARP experiment at CERN, and we've taken data at 8 GeV using our target slugs, which we're currently in the process of analyzing. And so later you'll see systematic errors resulting from beam uncertainties. Those result from our current level of uncertainty using these fits. They should reduce significantly when the HARP analysis is complete and we have our beam much better characterized. So that's sort of external. We have a series of internal systems as well, most notably the LMC. This is a system for trying to measure the kaon content of the beam and therefore infer the nu E's from kaons that result. It relies on the fact that the greater energy release in the kaon decay means that the muons produced can come out at wider angles than they can in pion decay. And so we have just a simple fiber tracker spectrometer at a 7-degree angle from the decay beam, and here's a Monte Carlo indicating the momenta that we expect in red, the muons from pion decay, and in blue those from kaon decay. So there's a clear separation, and this should enable us to characterize the kaon content of our beam. Shown here on the right is just an event display. This is probably in fact a pion rather than a muon, but it just indicates the trackers coming in, the dipole bending, the bend from the dipole magnet, trackers coming out. And in fact, it only doesn't make it beyond the first part of the range stack, so it's probably a pion. Moving on now to the detector. The detector is a 12-meter diameter sphere filled with about 1 million liters of pure mineral oil. The mineral oil volume is viewed by about 1,280 8-inch PMTs. Largely borrowed or taken from LS&D, and in fact the same PMTs that Snow uses. That provides about 10% coverage, and then there's a veto region in the outside here with about 240 PMTs. You can see a photograph here showing the two. Here's the main region with the PMTs painted black to avoid reflections, and here's the veto region painted white to enhance reflections. The neutrino interactions in the oil, of course, produce prompt Cherenkov light, but they also produce scintillation light, which is delayed. And I'll talk a little bit in a minute about some of our efforts characterizing the light production and transport. The heart of the analysis, the heart of the new appearance analysis on Miniboon, is particle ID. The key is going to be distinguishing electrons in our detector that result from new E charge current interactions from everything else. And so here's really sort of what it boils down to. New E-charge current interactions producing electrons. These tend to produce fuzzy rings. So this is the kind of thing that you're familiar with seeing from Super-K, from their particle ID. It's the same sort of procedure, where you've got distinguishing fuzzy rings from electrons, from the long straight tracks producing sharp rings filled in from muons. Our main source of background actually comes from neutral current pi zeros, where the two gammas are the Compton scatter or pair produce and give two rings. There are situations where we can lose one of those rings, and that can be a source of background. So this is the crux of the experiment. And shown on the far right here are real events from our event display. On the top, this is actually a Michel electron rather than a beam-induced electron. This is a muon here showing the crisp filled-in ring. And here there are two rings from a pi zero candidate. We have a very simple series of cuts that we can apply to get a pure neutrino candidate sample. And so when we operate the experiment, we trigger on beam from the booster, and we just open up a time window, 19.2 microseconds, just read out whatever is happening in the detector during that time. We then apply just a simple time clustering algorithm requiring looking for clusters of hits in time. And shown on the top here is the histogram. There's microseconds on the bottom of those times. Within this 19.2 microsecond window, the beam actually is 1.6 microseconds wide. And you can see here's the excessive events caused by the beam passing through our detector. You've seen similar plots to this from K2K when they do their analysis of the Super-K data. Now, most of this background here is coming from cosmics. And so if you make a simple cut requiring just minimal veto activity, you can significantly reduce the background. The remaining background comes from Michel decays. That's decays of stop muons, where the initial muon was before the trigger window, and so it was missed. But you've got the Michel decay. Since those are low energy, if you require more than a certain number of tank hits, you can kill those off and leave yourself with this very clean situation where you have a non-neutrino to neutrino rate of on the order of about 10 to the minus 3. So with some trivial cuts, you can get a very clean neutrino sample. My previous experiment was snow, and these plots just continue, will always blow me away that you can just get a pure neutrino data set with trivial cuts, unlike the case with the solar case. Our rates, we get about a neutrino event every 1.5 minutes, and so far we have about 300,000 on tape. largely because the experiment revolves around particle ID, it's important that we very, very accurately characterize the performance of our detector, not just its energy scale and resolution, but really all the details of how light propagates. So we have multiple systems for doing that. The laser calibration system, we have a series of flasks distributed throughout the tank. These principally are used to characterize the PMTs, both their charge and their timing response. We also care a great deal about exactly how the light not just is produced, but how it propagates. One of the features of mineral oil that you don't tend to see in water is that you get fluorescence, as well as scintillation and the more normal scattering and absorption. And so we have an ongoing program, quite an extensive program, to characterize our mineral oil with a whole series of offline sort of benchtop measurements, as well as our using in situ sources. The plot here just shows one interesting facet of this. This is fluorescence measurements from our mineral oil, where we're probing at wavelengths between 200 and 220 nanometers. These are wavelengths which are completely invisible to our PMTs. But what happens is that those low wavelengths can get fluoresced up to 300, 350 nanometers, which are visible. And that this is an effect which is now a function of distance, because there's a certain probability for fluorescing per unit track length. It's features like this that really put a premium on understanding in considerable detail the properties of our oil. And a little later, you'll see some of the effects of our uncertainties on that. We also have a muon tracker system. This is consists of a hodoscope above the tank, enables us to track muons into the detector. We have 7 scintillator cubes distributed throughout the tank. When muons stop, we get not only a sample of muons of known direction, but also of known position, known track length. And so shown here is comparing data in red with Monte Carlo in blue. This is the cube, this is the muon energy as determined from how far it went compared to the muon energy as determined from a reconstruction algorithm. And you can see that there's pretty good agreement between data and Monte Carlo sort of right across the energy range of interest there. We also care a great deal, of course, about electron energy response, not just muon energy. We have two sources here which are of use to us. Michel electrons up to an endpoint of about 50 MeV. This is here's a sample in blue of cosmic Michel data. In red here is an analytic fit, which is just the Michel spectrum convolved with a Gaussian. You can see a decent agreement, at least, with the data there. We also have Pi-0 candidates. I'll talk a little bit more about those in a minute, where we have, with a series of simple cuts, requiring a neutrino event that's in the fiducial volume that has two clear rings, each more than 40 MeV. You can reconstruct an invariant mass, and it sits pretty much right where you need it to be, the Pi-0 peak. You can tell from the chi-squared here that we still have a little bit more work to do, but you can also tell from the data points overlaid with the red Monte Carlo that we're really doing pretty well in terms of modeling this stuff. So in the last section, let me summarize where we are with some of our new mu analyses. So we're looking at several samples of new mus. They have interest in their own right for some of the things that Yoshi was talking about earlier with K to K, for instance, some of these low Q-squared anomalies. They also have interest, of course, because of they shed light on important facets of the new E analysis. In particular, we're looking at charge current quasi-elastic. The interest here, of course, is that this is the same cross-section that we're going to use to do the new E appearance. We're interested in neutral current Pi-0 production, both resonant and coherent. This is the main background to new E appearance. Neutral current elastic, the interest here is, in terms of the oscillations, the fact that you don't see the lepton from the top vertex enables you to study what the bottom vertex looks like in our detector, what that nucleon production looks like. Can I get the mouse to kill that window off? You just click OK, I'll be fine. Oh, thank you. So charge current quasi-elastic. We have, with some simple cuts, again, isolating neutrino events and then just looking for a single muon-like topology, you can isolate a sample that's about 80% pure. Shown here is the visible energy in GeV, the black data points. The red error bars come from propagating flux and shape and cross-section uncertainties. All these plots, I should also point out, are relatively normalized. The yellow here, these should not be considered error bars. They're merely an indication of what changes to the optical model can do. So by no means should these be considered to be one sigma error bars. They're merely an indication of the scale of the problem, that we really have to understand the optical model because it can have some quite noticeable effects. So on the top here is visible energy. On the bottom is the angle with respect to the beam. Here's the sort of low Q squared dip that Yoshi was talking about in the K2K stuff that we also see in Miniboon, which is the level of our understanding of that is similar to their level. There's a series of possibilities that we can't isolate just yet. If you make the assumption of charge current quasi-elastic, you can of course reconstruct a neutrino energy and a Q squared, and this is what's shown here. Again, black data points. Red error bars coming from Monte Carlo and cross-section propagation, and the yellow just giving an indication of changes to the optical model can do. Thank you. Neutral current sample. This is the same plot I showed earlier, which shows the clear Pi-0 peak. If you bin things up in the inferred direction of the Pi-0, you can then use the Pi-0 peak fit in each bin to get a yield. And so that's what we've done here with the red data points with statistical error bars overlaid with Monte Carlo, where the Monte Carlo, the interior error bar just comes from propagating the flux shape error, and the larger error bar is the same kind of indication of the effect of uncertainties in the optical model. Something you can see here is that the data appears to be shallower, less forward peaked than the Monte Carlo. This probably is telling us that we're overestimating the coherent contribution in our Monte Carlo. But again, it's a suppression at low Q squared, so it's probably also intimately connected to what we see in the quasi-elastic. Other variables you can look at with pi zeros, the lab angle, lab center mass angle, this of course is flat in reality, but the cuts, both the ring energy and the fact there are two rings, cause a distortion here. This area in particular is where we're interested for the appearance analysis, because this is where you've got one very forward gamma and the other gamma has been boosted to very low energies. So this is where most of our pi zero background to the new E appearance signal shows up. And the pi momentum is also shown here. I'm going to skip through the next slide and then talk about so with the experience that we've had over the last couple of years of data taking and analysis, we've updated our sensitivity to new E appearance. And so here is the summary's right after this. A pie chart sort of breaking down for a typical point in the LS&D space, we would expect to see about 300 new E appearance events. Very roughly the same number of background from MIS-ID and very roughly the same number from intrinsics. With the 1E21, if there is a signal, we should be able to isolate it pretty well within the LS&D region. And shown here is just the same, the what the energy spectra look like for those different regions. So let me summarize. The detector and all hardware systems are working very well. We have about 21% of the 10 to the 21 proteson target that we need. We already have, with 300,000 neutrino candidates, the largest neutrino data set in that sort of 1 GeV range in the world, and that data set is going to grow noticeably over the coming months. And the analysis algorithms and reconstruction algorithms are working nicely. We are on track to have the appearance analysis ready in time for getting 10 to the 21 protons on target, and we hope that that will be in 2005.
Thank you, Steve. Do we have some questions? Yes, there's two over there.
Steve, how have you been monitoring the stability of the oil like properties over time?
So I skipped through it rather quickly. We do these laser calibrations. We have this laser system, and in fact we have the system automated now so that we have a complete set of calibration constants generated every 4 days, which is a wonderful monitor of all kinds of effects going on. In short, we see nothing that moves, that changes at the level where it would be a concern. In addition, we have the cosmic Michels, of course, which are a very nice sort of standard candle for us to monitor things. And we do see changes in light output, particularly correlated with activity cycling the oil and bubbling nitrogen through it. But there are no changes which are at the level that you would worry about them being a systematic, a significant systematic effect.
Could you please describe in a little bit more details what goes into the red uncertainty band, which you showed?
Yes, let me bring that up. So here's an example. This is in this case.
I was talking about the quasi-elastic.
Oh, okay, fine. So something like this. So this comes from taking the flux uncertainties. So we do a fit to the pyrene production, and the uncertainties from that fit propagated into uncertainties in the flux and then into uncertainties in the interaction rate is a contribution there, plus uncertainties on the cross section, the quasi-elastic cross section.
But would it be possible to separate them, the flux uncertainty and the cross-section uncertainty?
Absolutely, yes.
So you don't have such a plot?
Well, it just for the sake of clarity in the plot, that was the only reason they were put together.
Yeah. Any other questions? If not, we'll thank Steve again.